Welcome to the Jay Martin Show. My name is Jay Martin. Amazing show today with Lynn Alden of Lynn Alden Investment Research. We began diving into domestic economic issues inside the U.S., then spread out to geopolitical implications that affect our portfolios, and wrapped up talking about capital allocation, meaning where are we putting our cash today? Phenomenal conversation. You're going to love this one. And as always, if you enjoy my content, I write a weekly essay every Sunday. It hits your inbox every Sunday. You grab a coffee and you join 40,000 plus other investors who get my Sunday essay, as I call it. And really all I'm doing is breaking down what I've learned through the week from conversations just like this. So anyways, hit the link beneath this podcast if you want to join 40,000 plus other readers every Sunday morning and hear from me with a Sunday essay. Here is Lynn Alden. Enjoy. Lynn, it's great to see you. Thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Happy to be back. Always happy to talk with you.
So let's start here. I'd love to begin with your high-level 2024 economic outlook. So what are you paying attention to? What's catching your eye? What are you expecting? Where's your mind at for this year?
So I think the biggest theme is fiscal dominance, which is basically that the size of U.S. fiscal deficits are impacting things more heavily than most other macroeconomic variables. So for example, it's more powerful currently than the Fed. Currently more powerful than the slowdown we've seen in China and other parts of the world. And I think the big question to watch is whether that's going to continue throughout the whole year or if that gets overridden at some point. There's a number of economic indicators that have been very weak for the past year and a half. So falling PMIs, for example, purchasing managers' indices, it's one of the more more important rate of change indicators of the economy. That's been, you know, in a downslope for quite a while. I believe it spent the most time below 50, which means contraction, without being official recession in history so far, which is unusual. We're also approaching kind of a long period of an inverted yield curve without an official declared recession. But on the other hand, we're seeing some of these indicators start to show signs of bottoming and turning up, reacceleration. And I think what makes this cycle different from a lot of cycles that people are familiar with over even a long investing career, let's say 40 plus years, is that this is the first time we're kind of in an era of structural fiscal dominance, meaning that it's not bank lending and corporate bond issuance that is driving things. It's that the fiscal deficits are largely driving things, or at least that the relative weightings of those two things are tilted more heavily to the fiscal side. So if you look at most of the past 40 plus years, if you sum up annual net new bank loans combined with annual net new corporate bond issuance, that sum was bigger than annual fiscal deficit that year. Outside of like really sharp recessions, that was normally the case. But what we're in now is a more structural, long-lasting period where fiscal deficits are bigger on a year-over-year basis than the combination of bank lending and corporate bond issuance. And you really have to go back to like the 1940s to find a similar type of environment. So there's not a lot of people that are kind of have that in their backtesting models. Not a lot of people have that in their mental models or their economic models about how markets work. And it's really new territory, because even when you do go back and compare it to the 40s, it's obviously a very different environment for many reasons. And so we're in kind of new macro territory here, where we have some example past where this went before, but none of them are perfect analogs. And so I think that the main question to watch is whether or not these fiscal deficits are enough to reaccelerate nominally some of the things like PMIs, reaccelerate energy pricing. We're also seeing, you know, potential Chinese reacceleration from a very low state. And so I think these are probably the biggest themes to watch in 2024.
Yeah, what's your take? Because people are so polarized on the China outlook, right? But it looks like industrial revenue is up 10% this year from last year. It was down 2%. I think there was a bunch of American global business leaders gathered in Beijing this week. So maybe like a follow-up meeting to when President Xi was in San Francisco last year. And he's working really hard to drive direct investment back into China. Do you have a take, Lynn, on the health of the Chinese economy and what metrics you're paying attention to?
So I think it's somewhat mixed. When you look at over the past 2 years or so, generally the output side, the industrial side, has been quite strong. So their exports are doing well. Particularly the car segment has kind of hockey sticked. So you know, in most of their history, they were exporting car parts. They weren't really exporting a lot of finished cars. But in the past 3.5 years, that ramped up like a hockey stick. And they actually outpaced Japan as the biggest car exporter. And in the United States, we don't really see Chinese cars on the road. But if you go to Egypt, if you go to many other countries around the world, you'll see a lot of Chinese cars compared to what it looked like, you know, 3, 5 years ago. And so they're kind of moving up the capital stack, you could say, or the complexity stack. So that they are doing really well in that segment. Obviously, where they're weak is that they've had a long-standing housing bubble. So very high valuations, along with a lot of debt tied to those high valuations for properties, which of course a very dangerous combination. And the leadership there is aware of the issue, and they've been trying to kind of deflate that slowly. But of course, when they deflate that, they fail to meet their GDP targets. They start to get discontent. And then they combine that with going after the big tech stocks. So going after Alibaba, going after Tencent, going after a lot of the other kind of big, you know, profitable businesses there. And then also, and that was all inside their control. And that's just kind of a kind of trying to doing a lot of things at once in a pretty authoritarian way. But then outside of their control, the whole, you know, Russia-Ukraine war happened. And so if Americans held Russian stocks, that, you know, even though the stock could be doing reasonably well, they just got zeroed out of their claims for those assets. And when a lot of investors look at China, they wonder what is the probability that happens to them in their investing horizon? So 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, what is the chance that there's, you know, they wake up and there's headlines in Taiwan, and then they wonder if any of their investments are still theirs or not? And so there's been a lot of, you know, foreign capital pulling out of China for a variety of reasons. So one of it is rule of law, just unclear around rule of law. They can wake up and decide, we don't like this company, we don't like this sector. And so we can just kind of damage that sector. And then also just things that are outside of their control, like, you know, should there be geopolitical conflict heating up? And so they've had kind of all these things together. But what we're starting to see is that as their equity market got very low, Chinese authorities started to come in and kind of support them. And also, as the real estate gets pretty weak, they are starting to kind of feel the pain and starting to kind of soften some of those policies. So I think there's a reasonable chance that it's kind of near a bottom, which is relevant because even if you're not interested in investing in Chinese assets, it's such a large market for global macro. Right. So part of the disinflationary impulse we've seen over the past, call it year and a half, is, you know, weak Chinese domestic demand. And should that start bottoming out and turning up, even if they don't reach their kind of prior growth rates, if they just kind of stop melting in the way that they have been, that could be an uptick for things like energy, things like copper, and just kind of overall reflationary forces. So I tend to be neither a super bull nor a super bear on China. I think their demographic issues are real. I think their debt problems are real. I think that the, you know, kind of the lack of like rule of law and kind of capital market like priority is a real problem. But on the other hand, I do think that they are and probably will continue to move up the capital stack. So they get into cars, they're getting into airplanes, they're getting into, you know, just overall kind of moving up that stack. They still have pretty low GDP per capita, pretty low energy consumption per capita. And I think those statistics are those metrics are probably going to be higher 10 years from now than they are now. So I'm kind of in the middle of the road on China, which is not the most satisfying answer. But when you combine that with some of the things we're seeing, for example, the US fiscal situation, that adds certain macro forces. And kind of one other thing I'll add is that China is currently running almost the exact opposite playbook of the US. The US has been trying to run tight monetary policy, but very loose fiscal policy, meaning, you know, high real rates, but also very high fiscal deficits, whereas China has been running pretty tight deficits, but they've also been kind of running pretty loose monetary policy, and so that tends to have kind of the opposite effect. So, you know, their output sector is still strong, but their consumption sector is weak, and that makes sense given the policy mix that they're doing. And I think it's important to realize, you know, for investors to realize that that always can switch. right? They, for example, they had their zero COVID policy for a long time. They were adamant about it. And then in 1 month, that all just kind of changed, right? There's enough pushback to it. And they all kind of were like, okay, we're going to pivot out of this. And you could see pivots out of China in terms of their policy. And I think we've seen kind of early signs of that as it relates to real estate and equity markets. But you could see that more in terms of overall fiscal monetary policy as well.
So I was curious how much, you factor in like geopolitics, I guess, into your investment thesis and just how you interpret the world. And obviously, you can't ignore China. Everyone's talking about their demographic issues and their real estate debt issues. I like how you pointed to the sort of like the maturation of the industrial productivity, though, and their climbing of the capital stack. Also, their energy consumption per capita is sort of a bullish sign in terms of consumption. That's how I interpreted what you shared, is that there's probably a lot of room to grow in terms of energy consumption on a per capita basis in China, correct? Which would be, that could be big.
Yeah, that's how I view it. And I also think, I mean, when you look at India as well, for example, India has better demographics, but even lower energy and
Right.
copper, kind of
Yes.
per capita.
Great
So I
point.
think, places like India and Nigeria might be the like bigger marginal drivers, but I still think China overall is still probably going to be a positive driver. A lot of people compare it to Japan, which in some ways I think is a fairly valid comparison, right? So Japan went through this period where they were a big structural industrial output source, but then they peaked in terms of demographics. And I think just the one thing to keep in mind is that even though China is going through a similar situation, they're doing it at a lower economic level. And so there still might be more runway ahead on a per capita basis, which could push against some of their, declining kind of population statistics and overall issues there. So that's why I'm kind of in the middle of the road on China. I don't really see necessarily a big collapse of any sort, but I do think that they're obviously fast growth periods behind them, and now they're in more of their muddling phase. And obviously, part of it's going to come down to geopolitics or what their president decides to do, because in over the past decade they have closed off a lot more. They were in this kind of multi-decade period of opening. And somewhat decentralizing, and in the past decade, they've been kind of recentralizing and reclosing themselves off and reducing transparency and kind of, and that's a trend that's probably going to continue. And I don't think that's super healthy.
Right. No, I like that because it's like to be honest, Lynn, it's like the anti-sensational answer. Maybe the pragmatic one is a better way of putting it. So I appreciate your take on that. Thanks very much. You mentioned one of the factors would be what their president decides to do. Do you think about what the American president might decide to do? I mean, there's a lot of saber rattling from the previous American president who may take the seat again come November. We'll have to wait and see. I asked because I had a guest on last week, Jacob Shapiro, who's more of a geopolitical analyst and quite tied into Washington. And he's forecasting that, well, I guess it's his opinion that the upcoming American election will be the biggest thing in geopolitics this year, which is neat. Well, neat. It's novel because it rarely is. I think deep in geopolitical circles, it's commonly agreed that the influence of the president isn't nearly as powerful as people perceive it to be. I mean, the beauty of the US Constitution is that it limits the power of any one man or woman. And although we obsess over who's in that seat, the choices in front of them are far more limited than we understand. I mean, that's sort of, the geopolitical take. Do you pay much attention to the saber rattling, to the threat of tariffs, to the threat of restarting the trade war on day one? And how do you process that?
So partially I do. It's not my area of expertise, but it's something I think you have to incorporate if you're doing macroeconomic analysis. You have to pay attention to what geopolitical experts are saying. You have to kind of pay attention to risks that are overall in those fields. I do think that in terms of domestic issues, I think especially domestic economic issues, I think the presidency is overweighted in the sense that the polarization of Congress. And kind of the locked in nature of a lot of the spending and taxation we have, that is, I don't think it's going to change that much given election outcomes. The things that do change more rapidly are kind of domestic social issues and then also foreign geopolitical issues. Those are the things that I think that there's a bigger influence on from an election like this. And
Okay.
so if you look at geopolitical issues, the one thing that actually Trump and Biden have fairly much in common is that they're both increasingly protectionist as it relates to China. So they're both kind of favoring domestic industrial policy And kind of pushing back against China to varying degrees. It's one of the handful of things that, even though their language might be very different in terms of how they communicate that, there's actually not a lot of policy difference. The Biden administration kind of continued the same things that the Trump administration had been doing. And so I think whether or not we get another Biden term or another Trump term, I kind of think those policies are probably going to continue.
And
I
those
think the big
policies being just broad strokes, pro-American industry, reshoring, friendshoring, items like this, Lynn, or what's on the
around the
left?
margins, yeah. So kind of restricting their kind of bifurcating supply chains to a little bit more. So in the sensitive areas, you know, chips, trying to encourage domestic production, trying to add tariffs. I think the challenge is, and I've written about this a lot, one is that the structure of the petrodollar system itself kind of heavily encourages U.S. structural trade deficits. We've had trade deficits for, you know, 50 years. And over the past couple of decades, China's really been exploiting them, but the system's kind of designed to make that, like, encourage that type of behavior. And so it's kind of like how China, one of their things, they want to control everything. So they want to control their current account, they want to control their capital account, they want to control their exchange rate. It's like they want to control everything, and that's just not how it works. You can only control a couple things, and the other things have to be the release valves for the things you're trying to control. But the US is kind of in a similar boat where they want the current structure of the monetary system to continue, but they don't want any of the drawbacks of that system. And so the kind of the way that works is that, you know, we run the global reserve currency. You know, a lot of global debt is denominated in dollars. It's the most liquid overall monetary network that exists. And so there's a lot of external demand for dollars. And what that does is it strengthens the dollar, it strengthens American import power, but it makes our export power less competitive, unless we're kind of focusing on very high margin things. So software, finance, you know, those healthcare, those types of areas. It makes us less good at industrial policy. And that's kind of an inbuilt aspect to it. That basically the way we meet the world's demand for dollars is running these big trade deficits. And there's obviously winners and losers. If you work in Wall Street, you don't really have an issue with that. But if you work anywhere in the center of the country or any sort of these industrial areas, you've been very harmed by that over the past several decades. And that's contributed to polarization. So I think that the US is going to try to run this more protectionist playbook with kind of limited success. You know, we're seeing that there's just not like these decisions are kind of multi-decade in nature, right? So if you look at China, for example, they have built up massive energy production. You know, they produce like twice as much electricity, for example, as the US. They produce like 10 times as much steel as the US. You know, these are kind of these are very long-term, structural, expensive trillions of dollars of infrastructure to shift over. Right, that's not something you just say, okay, in the next 2 years, we want to move a lot of that to Mexico, we want to move a lot of that to Vietnam, you want to move a lot of that back to the US. That's just not how that works. That's like a decade plus long decision that involves trillions of dollars of kind of moving and reinvesting in things. And then you go up against, you know, in the US, it's like, oh, we don't want to build more grid, we don't want to build more this, we don't want this in my backyard, we don't want to, what are the environmental impacts of this? Let's study this for the next 10 years, right? So that you have to go through all that as you're trying to shift any meaningful amount of that back, right? So I think a lot of that's about optics more so than the numbers necessarily being realistic in any sort of like 1, 3, 5 year period. And I think that's kind of one of the big investing things is kind of looking where the optics of the numbers kind of diverge, even in terms of human capital. Right, so the U.S. has plenty of really good software engineers and you know, obviously a big depth of finance expertise and healthcare, but making things like industrial policy is something where obviously they're very skilled people, but the number of skilled people is just not very high. And so, for example, when Taiwan Semi comes and tries to build a chip foundry here in the US, they keep reporting cost overruns, the inability to find all the right technicians that they need. Then they want to fly people over from Taiwan, and then there's pushback against that. They're saying what? So the local workers are not cutting it. And it's because human capital is another thing that takes a lot of time to build up. I mean, people learn for years and decades on the job. They pass that expertise down to people they train. And that's something that in the United States, we've really spent the last 20, 30, 40 years gradually gutting, and kind of pushing over to Asia. And it's not like you can just get that back in a couple of years. That's a multi, like a multi-decade thing to kind of start pulling that back toward the US.
Yeah, that's a great take. And I love the perspective on the divergence between optics and numbers, because that's the political game versus the real economy that often we get caught up in, right?
Yeah,
Yeah.
exactly.
So pivoting to capital allocation now, thinking about the average American investor, let's start with maybe what's undervalued and misunderstood. Does anything catch your eye in the market, equities, real estate, industries, Lynn, that you think the market's a bit too excited about right now and would be smart to temper themselves?
Well, so I think there's no shortage of things that the market's over exuberant about. So I think that large portions of the tech sector are pretty expensive. Anything that's kind of low volatility and growth oriented is generally priced at a premium. So for example, Costco is trading near 50 times earnings. It's a great company, right? But if you compare the valuation to growth ratio, it's very high, right? So there's people are paying almost anything to get a stake of Costco, and it's probably worth a lot less than that. And a lot of this happened back in the 2000 dot-com bubble. If you look outside of tech stocks, it's interesting. So things like energy and real estate were cheap, but some of these growth consumer products companies like Coca-Cola and Walmart, they were very overvalued in that era, and they spent the next decade and 15 years continuing to grow, but a lot of their stocks went sideways for like a decade because they had to burn off that high valuation starting point. And basically another way to phrase it, they had to let their fundamentals gradually catch up with their high stock price. And I think there's a lot of stocks today that might go through a similar thing where the fundamentals are real, but the next 5+ years of them are already kind of priced in. And so the real returns, I think, from these levels are probably unattractive for a lot of kind of growth oriented, high quality, low volatility types of names. The areas where I still think there's opportunity, for example, when I look at the energy sector, I see pretty high opportunity with fairly low risk in the sense that you get fairly strong balance sheets. For example, you get, pretty good valuations and profitability at current oil prices, let alone if you get higher oil prices. I think there's opportunities in midstream, for example. There's plenty of kind of areas depending on your risk appetite and volatility top appetite. But I think that's an area that's attractive. And I think an example of something that's cheap but risky would be something like Chinese equities, which is to say that I think there's a reasonable case that if you look back 5 years from now, this in the moment is a really good buying opportunity. Like sentiment couldn't be worse. Super like crazy cheap valuations. But the issue there is they come with this tail risk that if you're an American investor or a certain other investor, you just get zeroed out at some point, right? So it's like let's call it an 80% chance it ends up being a really good investment and a 20% chance that it's awful investment. And so and people might have different assessments of what those ratios, the probabilities are. So that's like a much harder decision to make, I think, than something like energy, which is I classify it as moderately low risk at these levels, but plenty of kind of long-term upside potential.
Okay, because decent balance sheets, great value, good valuations, and favorable profitability, even at these energy prices. Do you look geographically though, Lynn? Are you limited to certain regions of the world? Do you look for domestic production? Walk me through that.
So I like spreading out my jurisdictional exposure because there is a risk that obviously if energy prices are very high, and politicians, there's inflation, they blame the companies. They blame people for raising prices. They try to do windfall taxes on energy producers, that kind of thing. And so I'd be careful about having too much exposure to any one jurisdiction. I kind of want to have exposure to the sector and spread out my company risk, my jurisdictional risk. And for me, it's mostly a macro play on the entire theme rather than trying to say this company is going to outperform this other company. The only other kind of main bias I have in that area is toward companies that have long-lived reserves versus ones that have to constantly kind of drill and just kind of constantly recapture the reserves they already have. So I think that One of the trends we saw over the past decade has obviously been a rise of shale. There's been a rise of kind of faster to market types of oil. And I think that that trend, especially in North America, might be, slowing down. Not to say that all those gains are going to go away, but that the rate of change. So if you compare how much oil production there is in the U.S. versus 10 years ago, whatever delta that is, whatever number that is, I think the next 10 years gap is going to be a smaller number than that 10 years was.
Okay.
And so as these kind of faster oil markets maybe run into more headwinds, like a lot of the low-hanging fruit's been picked, I like having exposure to really longer-lived assets where possible.
And are there any ancillary opportunities if you're sort of bullish energy, broad strokes, outside of direct producers, any other ancillary industries that are appealing to you right now?
So on the conservative side, I think some of the midstream companies are attractive, like energy products partners, for example. Okay. If you compare the yields to treasuries along with a little bit of growth you get in them, I think they're pretty attractive. And on the riskier side, I think some of the oil services or some of the drilling assets are interesting. So for example, when you look at some of these drill ship companies, kind of one of the risks to the energy producer thesis is that if new production comes online faster than, say, my base case is, that could keep oil prices lower than my, say, 5-year base case expectations. And so how can I protect against that outcome? Well, it's by owning some of the companies that would benefit from a bigger uptick in drilling activity. And so there's kind of a bottleneck in terms of the amount of assets out there that are capable of helping these oil producers drill. Mm-hmm. And the shipbuilders would take years to make more of them. And they have been seeing structural increases in prices and utilization since 2021. And so I think that, it's a riskier type of business model overall. But I do think at least for this cycle, call it the next 3, 5, 7 years, there's a lot of attractive assets in that category as well.
And does your bullish sentiment on the energy sector extend through any other commodities, Lynn?
So I've been bullish on uranium since late 2020. I'm still, I'm not as bullish as I was when I initiated the position, but I'm still like the conditions have not structurally changed enough for me to no longer be bullish. So I am still bullish on uranium. And I think that as, over the past, call it 20 years, a lot of the tech we've seen has been not very energy intensive, right? So for example, this conversation we're having is not very energy intensive. Mm-hmm. Social media is not very energy intensive. If anything, the proliferation of smartphones has reduced many other things. So your smartphone, it replaces your need for a printer, replaces your need for all these paper products, or replaces your need for all, 10, 20 different things, or at least sure. It greatly diminishes those things. So it's actually pretty energy efficient. Whereas I think some of the tech we're going to see the next 10, 20 years, call it AI, is going to be more energy intensive, right? Mm-hmm. So image generation, video generation, thinking machines, right? These things, we kind of spent decades outsourcing our physical labor, and that was energy intensive. That's kind of what productivity is finding ways to automate things and finding ways to harness more energy. And I think that after this kind of local period of these tech things that kind of made things more efficient but not really energy intensive, I think we're going to see another wave of energy intensive tech, and that's going to probably propel the need for more nuclear over time. And so, even the supply demand situation for uranium with the existing nuclear fleet is already tight. And I think I think the nuclear story's probably got a long runway ahead of it. So that's another area that I like. And then copper is one where I am structurally bullish on copper, and just that tends to be quite cyclical. So I've been waiting for signs, that the PMIs globally are kind of rolling back up, that maybe China's reaccelerating, that the US is reaccelerating. If those end up being false starts, right, then copper could go through another year of not great results. But I think that so far copper has been confirming some of the reacceleration themes we've been seeing. So I am pretty bullish on copper as well.
You know, it's really interesting what you shared about AI demand on energy, because it would be very easy to just assume from a user standpoint, right? The user interface between ChatGPT versus WhatsApp doesn't seem that different. So it would be easy for the consumer to make the assumption or just miss the fact that the energy demand is going to go way up. Can you expand on that a little bit, the relationship between the AI boom and energy demand, Lynn? Any color you can add there?
Yeah, what I would say is that AI is as much a hardware story as it is a software story, whereas much of the tech that consumers have experienced over the past 10, 15 years have mostly been a software story. So for example, our computers are not really that much better than they were 10, 15 years ago. But really what's changed is how we use them. So social media, cloud computing, kind of all these like efficiency harvesting that we've been doing, all these ways for things to communicate with each other easier. And like I said before, folding a lot of different devices into one smartphone. You know, obviously there's energy usage and material usage in the smartphone, but the things you're displacing are similar or probably bigger in terms of their overall material energy usage.
Yeah.
So that's been a very low energy software focused thing. And of course the hardware enabled that, especially the mobile side. Once bandwidth and chips and computing got good enough to be mobile, that ushered in this very energy efficient era of kind of progress. And I think a lot of that low hanging fruit is now behind us. And obviously the big gains ahead are more, you know, can you use software to generate images and video and text and auto translations and helping one employee do the work of five employees, because they basically have four different, you know, part-time, you know, robot employees working under them, like software employees. But the difference is that those are not like little API calls. Those are not little like low bandwidth communication, social media stuff. That's actually hardware intensive, electricity intensive computations.
Right.
And so that has a, you know, it arguably takes more energy than it replaces, unlike the prior 10, 15, 20 years of tech. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that's a good thing. It can be a good thing, but it also has implications for the commodity sector overall, the energy distribution sector. And so I think that basically that people have to think more in terms of hardware and electricity than just, you know, kind of cloud calculations.
Yeah.
Right. So it's just, it's basically the nature of those calculations is just a lot more hardware and electricity intensive than we're used to when we think of tech.
Yeah. Thanks for that color. Another interesting driver behind energy demand. So you mentioned uranium. Yes, you've been mentioning uranium since I first had you on the show a few years ago. It's been a good trade to be in. I understand why you wouldn't be as bullish today as you would have been in 2020. I mean, a lot of money's been made in that sector and the price is up. But I agree with you. My long-term outlook's very favorable. Copper as well. Okay, Lynn, look, I want to thank you for your time and, you know, congratulate you on the success of Broken Money, by the way. I don't think I've seen you since that book came out. So your book became a bestseller. I know you've been pitched since then already by Eric to produce a Broken Energy book as a follow-up. And I'm pretty sure you're standing down from that one. But for anybody who hasn't read Broken Money and they want to hear more from you, I know we touched on a few of the key points today in this interview, but could you just lay out the thesis why you felt called to write Broken Money and what readers could expect if they want to pick up a copy?
Sure. And I appreciate that. Broken Money was kind of my biggest area of focus over the past year. And what it tries to do is draw from my combined finance and engineering background. And so what it does, it looks at the past, present, and probable future of money through the lens of technology. So when you read like a lot of monetary history books, they'll focus on human decisions. What did this central banker do and why do they do it? And what were the geopolitical implications of doing it? All that kind of stuff. And all that's important. But one thing I emphasize in the book is that, you know, politics affects things temporarily and locally, whereas technology affects things globally and permanently. So for example, you know, if one country decides to be capitalist and one country decides to be communist, that's going to have really big impacts for those people in that era. But for example, if someone, you know, invents refrigeration, that's going to gradually spread everywhere. And it's a one-way kind of permanent thing that exists now in humanity. And so as kind of technology around money changed, that changes the nature of how we do things. So, for example, a lot of people, when they look at the transition from gold to fiat, they think a lot in terms of human decisions, but a lot of it was tech. Basically, as the world became more and more interconnected with the telegraph and the telephone and all these kind of communication channels, all of our transactions started to move around the world at the speed of light, and our settlement layer obviously couldn't keep up. And so what that did was that resulted in a very large middle layer of abstraction and leverage and kind of net settling. And it kind of gave those middlemen, the bankers and the central bankers, quite a bit of power. And so what we've been in since then is kind of since 2009 and kind of progressing for the next 15 plus years since then, we've been finally in an environment where there's ways to move money quickly without going through kind of centralized banking and central banking environments. And there's a lot of hype and fraud and kind of risks throughout that new tech stack. But basically, it's exploring some of the ways that that can actually fundamentally transform some of the ways we do things. So it kind of basically all about money through the lens of technology and trying to take a really first principles way of examining it.
Okay. And, you know, the book was a success, obviously. Have you had any interesting questions or curious feedback that made you look at your thesis differently? Like in terms of the response to the book, any conversations spinning out of that, Lynn, that you'd want to share with us?
So I've been really happy with the feedback. I kind of wrote it. I kind of wrote the book I wish I had 5 years ago. And I think that whenever I write articles or any sort of content along those lines, I generally find there's a lot of people that have the same types of questions. Mm-hmm. And so it kind of broadens the research that I've done to answer my own questions. Mm-hmm. I think one of the interesting feedback is when people that are not really into some of the newer tech, like call it Bitcoin or stablecoins, when they read the book, one thing that stands out to them is that, you know, there's like five parts of the book all about monetary history, monetary technologies, things like that. And then the final part is about the intersection of technology and human rights and privacy and surveillance and permission. And so some people find that it's interesting to have like an ethical like subject in a book about finance. Whereas I view that as inherently linked in the modern era. I think it's incomplete not to have that kind of section. Sure. And so that's probably the most polarizing segment of the book, even though it's been well received overall.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, if I were to write a second book, I would try to write a more concise one. This one was intentionally kind of the full treatment. You know, it's something that I think deserved a fairly long, comprehensive read. I think that's what the market needed and what I wish I would have had 5 years ago. But I think that there's more niches for some of these smaller, more concise treatments of certain topics. So if I were to write a second book, it would not be the same type of lengthening magnitude of this particular one.
I see. Okay. You'd go in as a sniper next time. Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Got it. All right. Look, for anybody who wants to hear more from you, Lynn, lynnalden.com, or you're super active on Twitter. It's at Lynn Alden Contact. And would you mind just walking us through your publications, actually, that people will find on the website and what they can discover there?
Sure. So at lynnalden.com, I have free articles. I have a free newsletter they can subscribe to. And then also I have a low-cost research service, Lynn Alden Premium, comes out every 2 weeks, covers more specific investment opportunities, portfolios, things like that. And then also people can check out Broken Money on Amazon or elsewhere.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, and all my readers know that the 6 week cadence to your free newsletter is a no brainer for anybody who wants to stay on top of what you're paying attention to. It's amazing value because it's free, but it's great. It's great content. It's very well researched and very thoughtful. I appreciate that. So once again, Lynn, thanks so much for coming on the show. It's always great catching up with you.
Thank you.
All right. If you enjoy my content, do me a favor, follow or subscribe to this podcast. Drop me a rating and a review and share this with a friend. All of these things allow me to get bigger and better guests on the show. Now you can catch me all over social media at JMartinBC. Thanks for tuning in.